Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.
Hello again from Cannes. It's Michael Leader here, once more in the Little White Lies flat in the old town of Cannes, sitting on the sofa, nice and cosy, with Adam Woodward today.
Hi, good to be here.
So we're very deep into the second week now. I've been here over 7 days, and it feels like the festival's really cracking now.
I would say it peaked last night with two pretty exceptional films, which I think even going into the festival, they were right at the top of my most anticipated list, but both for me contained some amazing surprises. And I think, yeah, they've shot to the top of my list of the best films here.
And, well, these two films are Once Upon a Time in Hollywood by Quentin Tarantino and then Parasite by Bong Joon-ho, which were scheduled back-to-back in the festival, making that Tuesday evening, you know, the eye of the storm almost of the whole festival.
Yeah, you do tend to get this at Cannes, where they program just this one evening in the fortnight that just seems to come to a crescendo of these amazing films. And I don't know, I think the festival was good initially and it was very good over the weekend. I mean, we've covered a lot of the films that we've seen on here, but I think generally the competition's been really strong. Mm-hmm. There's certainly not been anything that I came out of thinking that was a real kind of waste of time or just wasn't on the level. But yeah, I think these two have really taken things up a notch.
And maybe listeners have seen film Twitter en masse talking about the long queuing situation for Quentin Tarantino. We don't need to talk about that too much, but it was an easy 2 hours queuing, and I was one of the last people through the door.
Yeah, there was a lot of elbow jostling and people not overly happy with people saving seats for
queue jumpers.
Yeah, I think the thing with the Cannes queuing system, it probably is quite nauseating hearing people whinge about it, because it's such a privilege to come here and attend and see these films in this amazing setting. But the Cannes organisers, I sense that they like the theatricality of it, and they want to create a bit of a storm and a bit of a buzz around a film. So Once Upon a Time in Hollywood was always going to be the hot ticket, but they put it on in not the biggest screen in the Palais, and I think probably under Tarantino's his kind of request, they knew exactly what they were doing and making sure that everyone really had to be there.
And part of the theatre at all, of course, was Quentin Tarantino himself issuing a statement to the press, almost like the Russo brothers for Avengers Endgame, saying, please don't spoil the ending. I love cinema, so please can we preserve the cinematic experience of going into this film not fully knowing what's going to happen?
Yeah, it was quite a short and sweet open letter that he put out, very much appealing to the critical, the masses here. But I don't know, I think there's something rings a bit hollow in that sentiment for me, especially when he sort of says in the statement, everyone put a lot of work and effort into this film, and it would be a shame for something to be taken away from that. And I think that's slightly disingenuous, because I think nobody goes in to make a bad film. Nobody sets out to make something bad, and everyone will always put their kind of best effort into it. So I understand why he's done it. Unfortunately, we live in times where, for better and for worse, you know, I think people are quite sensitive about spoilers. I think there are people out there that are not just kind of, you know, anonymous trolls, but there are people who kind of write professionally about film that do spoil films and quite openly. It depends as well who you're writing for and what the kind of audience is. Some of the trade magazines and papers out here, you read their reviews and they are a lot more like detailed and they reveal more about the synopsis and the plot, but that's exactly their prerogative. And I think something which has crept in over the years through film and television fandoms, which have been kind of growing, and it's a shame to sort of see that situation where you're getting those fans being pitted against the journalists, who I think certainly for us, we share people's enthusiasm and passion for these movies, and we don't want to detract anything from people's enjoyment of them. And I think Tarantino knows that, so I don't really know what he was really trying to achieve by picking at that.
Well, what can we say about Once Upon a Time in Hollywood then? Where to start?
The spoiler I think he's referring to is kind of teased, I think, slightly by the title of the film.
Okay.
Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, on one level, you could maybe interpret it as a sort of homage to Once Upon a Time in the West or Once Upon a Time in America, these films which he obviously has taken great inspiration from. But actually, I think it really neatly sets the tone for a sort of fairy tale fantasy. It's not so much a revisionist history, it's just his interpretation of a specific period in time, of this bygone era of Los Angeles in 1969. The film takes place over the span of about 6 months, and he really sort of immerses you in this world of movie making and Hollywood at that time. And you have Leonardo DiCaprio playing a sort of slightly over the hill TV Western star, Brad Pitt as his sort of best friend and lackey and stuntman, although we don't really see him doing many stunts.
No, the suggestion is that he used to be the stuntman, now he's more the driver.
Right.
Yeah.
But they are paired together in this film. Actually, amazingly, the first time they've been on screen together.
Right.
And it seems fitting that it would be in a Tarantino movie. But so, yeah, you sort of follow them on this journey through kind of old Hollywood, and scenes play out at length. And a lot of the time it's Leo as his character performing within films within the film, and Brad is kind of going about his daily chores, his routine. Really, the film is his film, I think. A lot of it is told from his perspective, and then in the background, of course, you have the very real life backdrop which Tarantino wove in. People were very anxious about this, I think, it being what happened with the Manson family murders in August 1969. I think he handles that actually in a very interesting and perhaps unexpected way.
Very unexpected, and I think we differ on how successful that is, but I think what we definitely agree on is this is such a rich film about Hollywood and TV and the period, and all of Tarantino's fetishes from feet to filmmaking are in full display here. The production design all the way through of the period, it feels like the entire landscape of visual media of the time is represented in some way, and you can just drink in the details. But then also Tarantino, as his later career has been more as almost a variety filmmaker, and there are these scenes where characters show up for one scene or for to deliver a nice little dialogue or a conversation with one of the main actors. And I think that's almost what I'd rather not, if I was going in to watch this film, I'd rather that not be spoiled. That's something that's in the trailer. Yeah. The returning actors, perhaps, or one scene cameos are really delightful in this.
Yeah, I mean, there are people who turn up in this movie who you won't find on the IMDb credits. And I like that. I like the fact he's bringing in people who he's worked with previously, actors he just admires. He sort of builds this larger world, this Tarantino-verse. And, you know, that goes down to the details of, as you said, some of the kind of movies he's referencing. Not only that, but the sort of fake in-world movies that he creates, and even like the products and the brands. It all, it feels very Pulp Fiction-y, I think, in that way. I just think the performances in this are so, so rich. And we know Leo is really good in these kinds of roles, and he's shown that with Tarantino before. Brad Pitt, I think, is just such a great, almost a kind of like conduit for Tarantino's own, it's like a projection of how Tarantino would like to see himself as this kind of old cowboy. He's just such a cool character, and he drifts through this movie in quite a kind of deliberate way. You know, you never feel like he's going off on these funny tangents that don't go anywhere. Actually, a lot of what he does, like, there's a scene where he sort of crosses paths with a young hippie from the Manson family, and that's a really interesting dynamic and relationship, I think, which Tarantino plays out. And actually, there's a lot of tension in some of those scenes, but it all sort of works. And and I think it builds this really surprising and actually quite poignant and tender finale.
Some people have compared it more to Jackie Brown, in the sense that there is a texture of emotion and feeling to this film. And I think that's Leonardo DiCaprio's performance as this, as you say, over-the-hill actor. It does really care for the lot of the star who never was, showing the vulnerability of the star. And I've never seen Leo give a performance like that, that is at once sort of tough, self-effacing, vulnerable, but also very broadly comic at times. It's a wonderful performance, and it is at the heart of this strange tone that this film has. It's not as openly provocative or cartoonish as you'd maybe expect from Tarantino, looking back at some of his more recent films from Kill Bill onwards.
Yeah, this is very serious movie making. Mm. And I think it's up there with Pulp Fiction and Jackie Brown and that kind of 90s heyday peak that he was in. And it's got this amazing glow about it as well. And it's just, he captures that sort of almost omnipresent optimism and sunniness of not just, I think, Hollywood at that time, but American culture, society. It feels like a dream of a movie in a way. Mm-hmm. And it is this fantasy that he plays out. Yeah, it's, I think, probably his most mature film. I mean, this is number 9 for him. Yeah. He counts Kill Bill 1 and 2 as a single entity. So, and he's always said he would retire after the 10th.
Right.
This feels to me like it could have been a more, or perhaps would have been a more fitting swan song.
Interesting. Well, it'd be very interesting to see how this goes down. There is the aspect we're not talking about, which I think would be fascinating to see how people respond to it, because the movie lives or dies by that final act.
Yeah, and the people have gone different ways on it here. I've spoken to so many people after the screening yesterday who completely see it differently to me. And I think that's great. How interesting, how exciting to have a movie that is divisive. I think for good reasons as well.
Yeah.
It's not divisive in the sense that it's schlocky or provocative or has this kind of nasty edge to it, which I think some of his films do. Mm-hmm. People have compared this slightly to Inglourious Bastards and that he's trying to rewrite an infamous kind of piece of history. And it doesn't really quite do it justice.
Well, it's, I guess listeners will be able to find out for themselves. It's released very sooner than over the summer.
I think it's coming out in the UK. I think it's coming out in July. It's he's going back to his kind of showpiece summer release. I think Hateful Eight was released in winter and still did quite well, but I think this looks like a not just a return to form, but should be one that I think a lot of people go and see. So yeah, I think it's one to look out for in the summer.
Terrific. And another film that we know will come out in the UK, there isn't a date, but we know it's been picked up for release, is Parasite, the Bong Joon-ho Korean satirical drama comedy. I guess we could call it that. I'm a big fan of his work. Admittedly, Okja might not have been his best. That was here 2 years ago and then on Netflix afterwards. But Snowpiercer, The Host, Mother, Memories of Murder, he's one of the best filmmakers working today.
Yeah, he has gone back to Korea and I think back to slightly his roots in terms of the kind of films and the mode of filmmaking he was in prior to his back-to-back English language films, which were Snowpiercer and Okja. So this is maybe not so much The Host, but it's even probably some of his earlier work before that. But it's a super dark and extremely funny parable about greed and capitalism. I think sometimes movies about that subject can feel a little bit like the message is kind of too, it's pushing the message a bit too hard on the viewer. What's so great about this is you could go into it just expecting a riotously kind of entertaining, almost like genre movie, and come away having experienced that and been satisfied just with that. And there's obviously so many levels to it beyond that. So yeah, people can come into it and experience different things. I think there's a lot going on. The character work, I think, is just sublime.
And performances.
It centres around this family who are essentially living on the breadline. The opening scene sees them scrambling around the house trying to find Wi-Fi connection because the free one they've been stealing from like a local bakery or something is just, they've just put a password on it.
Yeah.
And so it sets up this quite kind of comedic tone, but there's a slight melancholy note to it as well, I think, with this family, which I think represent quite possibly a kind of typical Korean family unit. There's been comparisons to something like Shoplifters, which won the Palme d'Or here last year. It is kind of like the evil twin, I think, to Shoplifters, with a bit of maybe The Handmaiden, Park Chan-wook's.
Well, someone this morning said it was almost similar to Us, the Jordan Peele movie, in that social satire and upstairs, downstairs relationship, as we'll find as you go further in the plot, I suppose. In the English language world, in the UK film industry and in Hollywood, genres are so fixed. You go in and you know what a social drama will be, what a comedy will be, what a dark satire would be. But in Korea, these filmmakers are just so creative and imaginative, where a film can be everything at once. And a film like a dark satire can be directed with the panache of a big budget spectacle, and this one is. It's just so delightful moment to moment, and as you say, the writing, performances are fantastic, and it's so deeply funny.
And he knows when to switch gears, and he knows when to turn up the level of whether it's the dramatic tension or the violence, or there's an amazing scene in a storm in this where it just suddenly comes out of nowhere, and it becomes again this kind of operatic, almost like what Paul Thomas Anderson does at the end of Magnolia. Uh-huh. It's that level of, like, it almost feels quite fantastical and otherworldly and just really strange. And watching the characters kind of wade through that is just fascinating and come out the other side. And it's becomes this almost like a home invasion movie, but where the people who are being invaded are somewhat in on it, or at least they're somewhat culpable for it.
I think we can say it's about them insinuating themselves into the lives of an upper class family, I suppose. But it's moment to moment, the use of tension and suspense and farce, and it can pull it all together to make a poignant, poetic statement that isn't a sledgehammer social statement, but maybe something deeper than that, resonant.
I think in Western cinema, I think we are lacking filmmakers who can deliver this kind of social parable, mm-hmm. as you say, with this level of technical craft and panache. I mean, we've seen Ken Loach doing his usual thing here with Sorry We Missed You, which it's not a satire, but it's trying to deal with big, very current social themes in a completely different way. But equally, there's nothing really new about what he's doing with that. And there's nothing particularly interesting about it, I think, either. It feels like he's kind of in a very comfortable groove with what he's doing. Bong is a filmmaker who really seems to push himself. Mm. You know, his films feel so assured and so confident, and he feels like he's completely in control of his craft and what he's trying to achieve. But, again, so many surprising elements to this, so many wonderful set pieces and just shots.
Yeah, and I'm so excited that it's getting a UK release from Curzon Artificial Eye, because Bong's previous two films, Okja, went straight to Netflix. It did have a couple of screenings, I think, for awards consideration. And then Snowpiercer, after years of being in limbo for UK distribution, finally limped onto streaming services this year or at the end of last year.
I mean, I would say definitely check out those two. Mm-hmm. I think we've done The Host on this podcast before as a film club.
Yeah.
You know, if you haven't seen The Host, that's definitely one to catch up with. Mother, I think, as well. Mm-hmm.
But luckily, all of his earlier films are available as well, I think, now. It's a better situation than it ever was, I think, to get on the Bong train. So we only have a couple of days left, really. I think competition films today that we'll be seeing are the Xavier Dolan and Arnaud Desplechin films. But it feels like maybe have we seen the Palme d'Or winner already?
I think so. Although saying that, I've been here before when something very unexpected and certainly not the critical darling has ended up winning, so you can never second guess the Cannes jury. Mm. There is still, I think, like 6 competition films to screen from 19 overall or something, so, or maybe it's 20 with the Tarantino, which was added a bit late, but it does feel like the festival's winding down slightly now. I think that I'd be very surprised. You know, Xavier Dolan has his fans, but I think he's not been on his best form recently. Arnaud Desplechin is great. Lover for a Day, which I think is the last thing he had here, was sublime, but this would be something to pull off topping either of the films that we saw yesterday.
Or Portrait of a Lady on Fire. Pain and Glory seems to be a critic's favourite as well. The Pedro Almodovar film. Feels like those are the consensus are forming around those films, really. Mm. It would be very exciting to see if they come out the other end with a few prizes at the end of the week. So Adam, Food Corner, as always, on these dispatches, we've tackled pizza, pasta, maybe finer dining. One thing we've not talked about is breakfast,
which is probably the most important meal here, because you're getting up every day pretty early. You need something to fuel you through the 3 or 4, sometimes 5 films you're going to see. So, yeah, we've got a few local spots here. Mm-hmm. There's a good place on the corner. You can get a good espresso and
a double espresso.
Double espresso, usually. Yeah. And there's good pastry selection. I think we were having this conversation about the difference between what I would know as a kind of cravat suisse, which is a sort of rolled, quite a long slab of pastry with chocolate and kind of cream in it. Mm-hmm. We've heard it's
a torsade also someplace. Yeah. It's fascinating. You know, neither of us are anywhere near fluent in French, are we? But when we try our hand going in and ordering, and then you realise that the thing you want is called something different in different patisseries, it's quite embarrassing and awkward. But yeah, we've had cravat suisse, torsade. I know it is a chocolate twist if you go down to your local supermarket in London, but that is the place on the corner. There's a pretty considerable one that really gets you through.
It's like half a foot long. You can't. I struggle to eat it in one sitting, but it's good. It's like a euro as well. It's such good value.
It is good value, and then double espresso is very important. Anyway, that's breakfast. We should probably crack on with the day now, shouldn't we?
I think there's a ferry just sounding in the background, which is probably not for us, but
it's going to take us on to today's films. We'll report back tomorrow with more takes from the Quasette. But for now, Adam, thank you for joining me today.
Thank you.
It's Michael Leader here, signing off from the Little White Lies flat for Truth and Movies in Cannes, presented by 7 Digital.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.